He cut around the crack.
And we flew the next day successfully, Davis said. That could have been the dumbest thing we ever did, but it was amazing. That was not how NASA would have handled it. But its officials agreed with SpaceX that there wasn't any reason why it wouldn't work, and approved the launch, astounded by how quickly SpaceX was attacking the problem. Now, as Dragon was in trouble with the stuck valve, NASA was similarly hands-off. Bill Gerstenmaier, NASA's Associate Administrator for Human Exploration and Operations, and Michael Suffredini, the space station's program office manager, were in the Launch Control Center watching over SpaceX's shoulder as they tried to figure out how to burp the valve. They were two of the agency's most senior officials, with nearly 60 years at NASA between them. They had served through the shuttle disasters, had seen all sorts of problems in space, and now, as NASA faced another potential crisis, they were just talking softly between themselves. Standing nearby, Lori Garver, NASA's deputy administrator, could barely contain herself. SpaceX's Dragon was in trouble. Deep trouble, it seemed. If it didn't dock with the station, if the mission somehow failed, the critics would come out again to blast Obama's decision to rely on these contractors. This mission had to work. They had to find a way to rescue Dragon, and fast. There were no better people to come fix this than Gerst, as he was known, and Suffredini. But there they stood, two of NASA's elder statesmen, just watching, offering a bit of advice, a whisper here, a suggestion there, to the SpaceX kids. And really, they looked like kids. But mostly, both were staying out of the way, letting the kids figure it out. Garver desperately wanted them to take over, to swoop in and save SpaceX. But instead, they stood back. They were like grandparents instead of parents, Garver recalled. And it was almost like Grandpa taking them fishing. Try over there. There might be some fish over there. A soft touch, designed to let the kids learn to fish on their own, rather than an impatient dad's just grabbing the pole and catching the fish for them. If there was something we saw that we could have interjected, we would have done it, Gerstenmaier recalled. But it wasn't NASA's spacecraft. The wise elders weren't in control. We really were in an advisory role, Suffredini said. We couldn't give them any help but high-level guidance. As they watched, the kids in the control center were making progress on the problem. The valve was stuck, so they'd need something to make it unstuck. On a spacecraft circling the globe at 17,500 miles per hour, that was no easy task. But the SpaceX team knew that if pressure could be built ahead of the valve, and then it was suddenly released, that might just deliver the kick needed to jar the valve open. It's like the spacecraft equivalent of the Heimlich maneuver, Musk said later. One of the engineers wrote a command right then on the fly, programming the spacecraft to build up the pressure. Then they tried to beam the new command up to the Dragon, as if it were an iPhone update. At that moment, the folks at NASA knew they were witnessing something special. It wasn't that they had fixed a problem with the spacecraft. That happened all the time. It was how fast they did it. The SpaceX mindset had always been about adapting quickly, and it really shined that day, Suffredini said. They had really an in-depth understanding of that system and the software. And that's one of the secrets of their success. They probably had the kid in there who wrote the original code. But the SpaceX crew was having a hard time communicating with the spacecraft. The code wouldn't transmit. So, someone got the Air Force on the phone, which then gave the company access to a more powerful satellite dish, which allowed, at last, the uplink. The code worked. The valve opened. Dragon was able to dock with the station. The whole SpaceX team could take a deep breath. That was nerve-wracking, Musk said later. For a while there, we thought we'd have to abort the mission. But we were able to upload new software and make it work. Watching from a distance, the grandparents were pleased. SpaceX had caught a big fish all on its own. It was a turning point. SpaceX's rite of passage, an entry into adulthood. It had matriculated and was now granted membership into the rarefied Old Boys Club. But nothing would symbolize the apotheosis of SpaceX, and by decree the emergence of the new space movement it was now clearly leading, except the transfer of 39A into private hands. By 2013, Musk had set his sights on winning 39A, and it seemed inevitable that he would add the world's most venerable launch pad to his growing trophy case. As far as some in NASA's leadership were concerned, the agency should just sign the pad over to SpaceX, no questions asked, and be grateful that someone was willing to take it over. But others knew that would be a problem. They needed to bid it out, if only for the sake of procedure. Of course, they'd get no other takers. Who would want a used launch pad that would require millions to restore? Then, from out of the blue, NASA received another bid. This one a surprise from a little-known company that had for years remained quiet and secretive. But now, Blue Origin was slowly emerging from the shadows. A year earlier, in October, Garver had visited Blue Origin again, this time at its facility in West Texas. By now, almost a decade after Bezos had begun buying up the land in secret, there was a fully functioning launch facility, complete with an engine test stand and a launch site. Garver was particularly interested in the test stand, since NASA was looking into refurbishing one of its own at a cost that seemed astounding to her, $300 million. As she toured Blue Origin's test stand, she asked her guide, a young engineer, whether he knew how much it had cost to build. His answer? Somewhere in the range of $30 million. 10 times cheaper. She was stunned, and reminded again of how efficient private industry could be. "Can we test our rockets here?" she asked the people at Blue, who demurred, not wanting to deal with the government bureaucracy. In addition to the test stand, Blue had an odd chart to show her. On the wall in one of the offices was a grid laid out with a series of squares. Each square represented a plot of land in the Texas desert. In a couple of days, the company was going to perform what was essentially a fire drill in rocketry, a pad escape test. The idea was to demonstrate that if anything went wrong with the rocket, the capsule sitting on top, holding the astronauts, would be able to fly away to safety. For the test, they'd put the capsule on the launch pad and then fire its motor to ensure that, in the case of a problem with the booster, the spacecraft would be able to get the crew away as fast as possible. The grid that Garver was now looking at represented the spots where Blue's employees thought it would land, after flying a couple thousand feet into the air and then parachuting back safely to the ground. The Blue Origin team made a game of it. For $5, you could pick a square. And then if the capsule landed there, you'd win. Garver made her pick, but told them that if she won, she'd donate the winnings back to the team. A few days later, on October 19, 2012, Breton Alexander, Blue's director of business development, sent her an email. "Success," read the subject line. "Awesome pad escape test," he wrote. "Need to review data, but looked beautiful." "Oh my, congrats, I was just going to write you," she responded. "By the way, you were one of 11 winners who picked the winning square. We were 11 feet from the predicted mean location. And we've spent your winnings on beer, scotch, and tequila." Winking smiley face. Alexander wrote back. "You got a great shout out for your game and accuracy." Smiley face. A few months later, in January 2013, Blue had some more news. In an email, Rob Meyerson, the company president, wrote to NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden and Garver to say that the engine that would power its New Shepard rocket was making significant progress. "My apologies for not making it up to the Museum of Flight today for your visit," Meyerson wrote on January 15th. "I had planned to go, even had my coat on at one point, but decided to stay back in Kent so I could watch the first test of our new BE-3 engine, which was conducted at our West Texas site. The BE-3 is a Blue-developed 100,000-pound thrust rocket engine that uses liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen as its propellants. After overcoming the usual first test obstacles, we were able to get the test off around 4 p.m. today. It was a tremendous milestone for Blue Origin and the result of many years of effort. He went on to thank NASA for its support, saying it helped the company save about a year in development time. This was indeed a tremendous milestone. And huge news, a Henry Ford moment. Jeff Bezos was building a rocket engine. Garver immediately sensed a public relations opportunity for NASA and the White House. Since they had backed Blue with $25.7 million in contracts and were supporting the private space industry, she wanted to shout this success to the rooftops. Let all those doubters in Congress, in industry, even in NASA's own leadership, know that these companies, with help from the government, could succeed. Your note about NASA's assistance saving you a year of development time is especially welcome, Garver wrote to Meyerson. I'd really like to be able to communicate that message more broadly in upcoming speeches, testimony, etc. Are you folks open to coordinating on such a message? I know you are the quiet company, she continued, so I don't want to presume to be able to share the information. And either way, it is really wonderful to see the government industry teams working with such synergy. There would be an announcement, but not until more than a month later. And the news of the engine test was mentioned only in passing, as part of a broader press release from Blue about how it was continuing to test its engine through a partnership with NASA, though without receiving any additional funding. Through 2014, the company planned to continue to test its rocket and capsule methodically, putting emphasis on power and actuation systems, in-space propulsion, multiplex avionics, and flight mechanics. The company also will progress the spacecraft's guidance, navigation, and control systems. In other words, Bezos was getting ready to fly. Bezos wanted 39A for the new rocket it was developing in secret that went by the nickname Very Big Brother in-house. The launch site was a national treasure, one he had been fascinated with since he was a 5-year-old kid watching the crew of Apollo 11 take off. A seminal moment for me, as he later commented. If Musk won the exclusive rights to it, it would be as if NASA was saying it had chosen SpaceX as the rightful heir of Apollo. Blue Origin had remained content to be on the sidelines for the better part of a decade. But no longer. That silence ended now. Launchpad 39A, and all that it represented, were too big a prize. If NASA was giving it up in its will, Bezos would make a bid. Bezos' team had tried to win the rights to 39A by arguing in 2013 that the venerable pad should not be operated exclusively by any one company. Unlike SpaceX, Blue Origin promised to share it with others, such as Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and even SpaceX. NASA looked at both proposals and studied the pros and cons. Musk and NASA had already had a long-running relationship. NASA was investing billions in SpaceX. Even President Obama had blessed the company, if implicitly, by visiting Pad 40 a few years before. The fact was, Blue Origin didn't yet have a rocket capable of launching from 39A. The hare had sprinted far, far ahead. The tortoise's slow, deliberate approach might one day allow it to catch up, but now it was too far behind. The competition wasn't even close. Musk won, hands down, adding the iconic pad to a long list of triumphs, which now included besting Bezos in their first high-stakes head-to-head clash. It might have ended at that, but Bezos wasn't about to give up. Blue Origin sought to reverse the award by filing a legal protest, arguing that the criteria NASA used to come to its decision were flawed. It argued that the launch pad should be a commercial spaceport that several companies could use. Then, to bolster its case, Blue Origin enlisted the support of the United Launch Alliance, the joint venture of Lockheed Martin and Boeing, SpaceX's chief competitor, which was eager to join the fray in a move it knew would only antagonize Musk. The alliance jumped wholly into a nice, convenient partnership with Blue, a marriage that brought together the heritage of a legacy contractor with the innovation of a new startup, not to mention one backed by one of the wealthiest men in the world. In a statement to Space News, the alliance said that it would continue to share our technical expertise in launch infrastructure with Blue Origin, which in turn would allow 39A to have multiple tenants. It enlisted the aid of friendly senators, who, in a letter to Bolden, the NASA administrator, wrote that blocking use of the pad to all but one company would essentially give that company a monopoly, stifling competition in space launches, and therefore raising costs. The legal protest was a case of launch site envy. That was annoying, Musk said later. Filing a lawsuit for 39A when they haven't even gotten not so much as a toothpick to orbit. So, it was absurd for Bezos to claim that Blue Origin should get 39A. The protests, the lobbying in Washington, and the sudden back-channel union between the Alliance and Blue infuriated Musk, who had also grown agitated that Blue Origin was beginning to poach some of his employees. In his biography of Musk, Ashley Vance reported that SpaceX even designed an email filter designed to search employees' emails for Blue Origin. The dispute over 39A wasn't their first entanglement. In 2008, SpaceX sued Matthew Lehman, one of its former employees, alleging he had violated his contract, that Blue Origin used the information he provided to attempt to recruit multiple SpaceX employees with specific and detailed knowledge of SpaceX's design efforts and of extensive confidential SpaceX information relating to those design efforts, the lawsuit claimed. Blue Origin utilized extreme measures to entice these carefully targeted SpaceX employees to leave their SpaceX employment and join Blue Origin. The lawsuit was eventually dismissed, but the tensions lingered. And now the fight over 39A only inflamed them. Musk fired off an email to Space News in September with an epic takedown of his new competitor, deriding the protest as a phony blocking tactic. And an obvious one at that. Even though Blue Origin had been around for a decade, it has not yet succeeded in creating a reliable suborbital spacecraft, he wrote. It is therefore unlikely that they will succeed in developing an orbital vehicle that will meet NASA's exacting standards in the next 5 years, which is the length of the lease. That said, I can't say for sure whether Blue Origin's action stems from malice. No such doubt exists about ULA's motivation. There was a subtle jibe laced in there, one that most people would miss, but that was of great importance to Musk. As he would point out again and again over the years, Blue's New Shepard rocket would be suborbital, and therefore not nearly as powerful as the boosters he was building that were capable of reaching orbital escape velocity, the speed needed to break Earth's gravity and stay aloft in orbit. Blue's New Shepard, by contrast, would go up and then come straight down, like a ball tossed into the air. However, rather than fight this issue, there is an easy way to determine the truth, which is simply to call their bluff, Musk continued. If they do somehow show up in the next 5 years with a vehicle qualified to NASA's human rating standards that can dock with the space station, which is what Pad 39A is meant to do, we will gladly accommodate their needs. Frankly, I think we are more likely to discover unicorns dancing in the flame duct. Unicorns in the flame duct. Whether he meant it to be or not, this was a rallying cry to his troops, who delighted in how bold their leader could be. There was, however, an irony. Musk was treating Blue the same way Boeing and Lockheed had treated SpaceX a decade earlier, when it was filing lawsuit after lawsuit trying to enter the market. The legacy contractors had derided SpaceX, calling it an ankle biter, saying it wasn't a serious challenger because it did not have a proven rocket. Blue could have responded to Musk's taunt by announcing that it was also developing an orbital vehicle, very big brother, thank you very much, one that would be powered by new engines made in-house. But it didn't take the bait. Musk's insult didn't produce anything but more of the same obsessive, disciplined silence. Bezos was sticking to his own advice, written in Blue's founding letter a decade earlier. Be the tortoise, and not the hare. Victorious, SpaceX started work immediately, renovating 39A. The Kennedy Space Center was to space what the White House was to politics. Only now, one of the jewels of the Space Center had a corporate insignia on it, a giant SpaceX logo spread across the side of a massive warehouse. It hadn't yet gotten to Mars, but SpaceX had planted its flag on some of the most sacrosanct soil of the Florida Space Coast. The company was moving on, looking to the future. But the spat with Blue Origin left many at SpaceX angry. The launch site director took a photo of about 100 blow-up unicorns that he had placed in the flame duct. And, in a tucked-away conference room in its Washington office, there was a picture of Captain Jean-Luc Picard, the star of Star Trek: The Next Generation, a follow-on to Bezos' favorite childhood television show. A bubble coming out of his mouth read, "What the fuck does Blue Origin need a Florida launch pad for?" Part 3. Inevitable. Chapter 11. Magic Sculpture Garden. Jeff Bezos blamed the bananas. In early March 2013, he had quietly stolen away from his growing Amazon empire for a three-week expedition at sea, with a team of some of the best deep underwater ocean explorers in the world. Yet, despite its vast experience, the crew had somehow violated one of the oldest seamen's superstitions. Never bring bananas on a boat. The crew of the Seabed Worker, a Norwegian salvage ship outfitted with the most advanced underwater robots money could buy, had packed in bananas by the bushel. And now, as the ship was getting battered by a late winter storm the Weather Channel had dubbed Saturn, the curse of the bananas had come to haunt them. Saturn had swept from the Rockies east through the Midwest, coating a vast portion of the country in snow before coming out at sea, where its winds were churning the Atlantic Ocean into frothy, menacing waves. Some 15 miles off the coast of Maryland's Assateague Island, the storm pummeled a 67-foot fishing vessel, shredding the hull and killing two members of its three-man crew. Soon it was rocking the Seabed Worker and its crew of 60, which included not only the all-star team of explorers Bezos had assembled for this secretive mission, but several members of Bezos' family as well, his parents, brother, and brother-in-law. This was supposed to be a family-friendly trip of adventure and discovery, a quest for lost treasure on the high seas. But then the storm stalled overhead. The winds howled, and waves towered over the ship, spraying in thick, drenching sheets that cascaded over the hull as the ship bobbed to and fro like a metronome. They considered trying to escape to the south, but the storm was too big. They had no choice but to ride it out. It was a slow day in July 2010 when David Concannon got the call in his law office in Philadelphia's main line. The caller would only give her first name, and though she said she was calling on behalf of a client, she didn't say who it was. Concannon had been getting a lot of crazy calls lately. Just the other day, someone had urged him to go search for a secret fort down by the airport, which had been built by the Knights of Templar, a 12th-century Christian military order. This woman seemed like just another crackpot. "But I was bored that day, so I talked to the person," he recalled. Finally, she allowed that she worked for a high-net-worth individual, and came out with her question. Would it be possible to recover the F-1 engines from the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean? Concannon had no idea what she was talking about. He Googled it and realized that F-1s were either from a race car or the Apollo-era Saturn V rockets. The former meant nothing to him. But recovering the engines from the rockets that took astronauts to the moon? Well, that would be a coup. Especially for an explorer like him. In addition to being an attorney, Concannon ran a consulting firm for explorers. For years, he had helped put together expeditions to Mount Everest and to the bottom of the ocean, where his teams had helped recover artifacts from several sunken ships, including the Titanic. "Yeah, it's possible," he responded. "Anything's possible." But it would be exceedingly difficult, as he discovered researching what it would take. Even more challenging than finding the wreckage of the Titanic. The Titanic was 883 feet long and weighed more than 52,000 tons. On the ocean floor, it stood 6 stories high. The explorers that found it in 1985 had decent information on where precisely it sank. And, perhaps more important, previous expeditions had searched hundreds of square miles, so they knew where not to look. The F-1 engines, by contrast, were tiny. Like finding a deck chair or a boiler on the Titanic, Concannon later recalled. No one knew where they were. At least, not exactly. Once the Saturn V took off from the Kennedy Space Center's Pad 39A, its first stages separated and fell back to Earth, where they eventually splashed down into the ocean. But no one had tracked their descent. NASA had only a vague sense of the impact point based on the flight path. But the space agency didn't track them on radar, and didn't even issue a notice to mariners, warning ships to steer clear of the area where a rocket booster would be falling from the sky. Even if the engines could be found, it was unclear what kind of condition they'd be in. Maybe, red hot, they'd torn apart when hitting the cool Atlantic, shattering to pieces. Maybe after 40 years on the bottom of the ocean, they had deteriorated away. When Concannon first saw the wreckage of the Titanic, sitting off the coast of Newfoundland at a depth of 12,460 feet, where the pressure is more than 6,000 pounds per square inch, he was shocked not by its grandeur, but rather by its appalling condition. "The Titanic looks like it is made of wet sand," he once wrote in an account of the mission. "The ship looks nothing like I imagined. Instead, it appears to be rotting away, like a candle melting from the top down. It's easy to believe that the Titanic will be nothing more than a stain on the ocean floor in a few years." The Apollo engines could be in similar condition, or worse. And that was assuming they could be found. Whoever was behind this mysterious phone call would have to have immense amounts of patience, not to mention money. The person would also have to be comfortable with attempting a mission most people would classify as foolhardy, if not impossible. A month later, the mystery woman called back. Her boss was interested in proceeding, and now she was ready to reveal his identity. Jeff Bezos. Concannon wasn't surprised. He was not aware that Bezos had interest in space, or even ran a space company, but he had worked with lots of rich people, and even some celebrities, including James Cameron's Titanic trip, to know that wealth often fueled eccentricity. To Bezos, the engines were the embodiment of the Apollo missions that had inspired him as a 5-year-old. He was fascinated with the F-1s, their brute power, and called them a modern wonder. The engines had 1.5 million pounds of thrust each. All 5 together burned through 15 tons of fuel per second and fired for just 2.5 minutes before the rocket's first stage separated and fell into the ocean. It's hard to find something more profound as an engineered object than the F-1 engine, the most powerful single-chamber rocket engine ever designed and manufactured, he said. 65 of these engines flew, and there were 0 failures. While they might have been hunks of steel to others, with no real significance, to Bezos, they were important artifacts. "These are the actual objects that first took humankind to the moon," he said. "They're a marvel. For me, they conjure the memory of the thousands of passionate engineers who brought the Apollo program into existence." But they had been sitting on the bottom of the ocean for more than 4 decades. And they weren't going to last forever down there, he said. At the time, Blue Origin's New Shepard rocket was well under development. Compared to the 363-foot-tall Saturn V, it was a pipsqueak, just 65 feet tall. Its single BE-3 engine was capable of just 110,000 pounds of thrust, compared to the F-1's 1.5 million. But the little New Shepard was being designed to do something that the Saturn V could not. It would be able to launch to space and then fly itself back to Earth, autonomously, adjusting its course on the way back down, able to guide itself precisely back to a landing pad, so that it could fly all over again and again. To Bezos, then, the F-1s not only represented the Apollo era's gargantuan feats of engineering, but would also be reminders of how rudimentary they were, of a time when rockets were expendable, never to be used again. Once recovered, they'd be showcased where they belonged. A museum, representing perhaps humanity's most historic achievement. But hopefully, they would also come to be seen as a relic, as antiquated as a horse and buggy. Blue Origin is determined to write a new chapter. Reusability, Bezos would later say. That's the key to making space travel affordable. No more throwing engines away in the ocean. We don't want anyone to be able to recover our engines from the Atlantic 50 years from now. On September 24th, 2011, Concannon's crew took off from Newport News, Virginia, in a former Navy spy ship, the 224-foot-long Ocean Stalwart, which had been overhauled as a research and surveying vessel. This was a reconnaissance mission, dispatched by Bezos in an attempt to see whether they could find the engines. The ultimate goal was to find an engine used during the Apollo 11 mission. Bezos wanted a piece of the historic lunar landing. If the crew was successful, it had come back at a later time in a separate expedition with Bezos to recover what they had found. The 180-square-mile search area, a few hundred miles off the Florida coast, where they thought they would have their best luck, was going to be at extreme depths, more than 14,000 feet, about 2.5 miles down, deeper than the wreckage of the Titanic. There, the ocean floor was like a moonscape, ghostly and largely devoid of life. Sunlight didn't penetrate at that frigid depth, making it completely black. The water pressure was 7,000 pounds per square inch. Instead of searching the ocean floor with cameras, they'd use sonar, pulses of sound that would reflect off objects on the seafloor and measure their distance and bearing. Sonar would allow them to scan greater distances, as much as 4,000 feet, or even something as small as an airplane propeller from a distance of more than 10 football fields. But getting the sonars to the seafloor was a tremendous undertaking. The ship had to be able to keep its position, without an anchor, by using its engine thrusters while being pushed around by the currents, waves, and winds. The side-scan sonar system affixed to a 15-foot-long, 6-ton towfish that looked like a mini-torpedo. The towfish were lowered to the bottom of the ocean by a spool of cable, 32,800 feet long, that by itself weighed more than 20 tons. In all, the sonar system cost more than $1 million. Once the boat was in position and ready to search, it took 5 hours to lower the towfish into position, where it would begin scanning the ocean floor, identifying anything that could be a rocket engine. Over 2 weeks, with crews working around the clock, the team created a map of the ocean floor across the search area. The painstaking effort paid off. They found thousands of man-made objects, and more than 300 so-called high-value targets they felt could be rocket engines, clustered in 18 different areas. After studying the data, Bezos announced the discovery several months later in a blog post. "We don't know yet what condition these engines might be in. They hit the ocean at high velocity and have been in salt water for more than 40 years. On the other hand, they're made of tough stuff, so we'll see." The engines were found. Now, they had to get them up to the surface. In February 2013, as the White House was fighting to kill the Constellation program, and Musk was about to meet President Obama at Pad 40, a Norwegian ship took off from Bermuda, ready to recover the engines. Funded entirely by Bezos, it had the best of everything in what was surely a multi-million dollar undertaking. Concannon had assembled an all-star team, including John Broadwater, the former chief archaeologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and Vince Capone, one of the world's leading underwater search experts. The team brought along a doctor as well, Ken Kamler, a specialist in expedition medicine, who had served on many perilous adventures, including to Mount Everest, where he treated the survivors of the trip chronicled in John Krakauer's Into Thin Air. In all, about 60 people were aboard, including Bezos himself, who would spend as much as 3 weeks at sea, away from his Amazon empire, though he'd spend stretches in his cabin with his computer, working during the downtime. Later, he would say, it was so fun having members of his family along. It was meaningful to share the experience with his parents, Jackie and Mike, his brother Mark, and his brother-in-law, Steve Poor. Since Jackie was the only woman on board, the captain jokingly told Bezos that he would remove all pornography from the ship's common areas. For this mission, the team acquired a recovery ship known as the Seabed Worker, a marvel that towered 6 stories over the ocean, was 290 feet long, and weighed almost 4,000 tons. The cockpit, or bridge of the ship, looked like the command center of a massive spaceship, with a large plush chair for the captain, as well as joysticks and several computer screens that relayed all sorts of data in real time. And it was outfitted with what's known as a dynamic positioning system, which uses GPS to keep the ship precisely over a target. Perhaps most important, the Seabed Worker had 2 remotely operated vehicles, ROVs, essentially underwater robots that could be controlled from the ship. These $7 million ROVs were able to work at extreme depths. "We're working 3 miles down in the deep ocean," Capone said, "and our robots are like marionettes on 3-mile-long cables. Being able to control those robots is a fantastic deep-water ballet." The weather was rough as the ship powered its way 500 nautical miles southwest from Bermuda to the recovery site. But the Seabed Worker was a gallant trooper, able to absorb the waves, allowing the crew to operate the ROVs in seas as high as 15 feet. By the time they got to the search site, on March 2, 2013, the weather had calmed. They were ready to start plucking metal from the depths. "You can feel it walking around the ship. Everyone's excited," said Jeff's brother, Mark. "There is some level of trepidation, because we know there are no guarantees." The ROVs made it to the seafloor at 11 a.m., Sunday, March 3rd, and almost instantly beamed back images of engine parts that were broadcast in high definition on large-screen TVs installed just for this mission. "We found the first artifact within minutes, and found the first engine within the first hour of that first day," Concannon said. There, on the ocean floor, were the thrust chamber, turbo pumps, and heat exchangers. To some, they'd look like twisted hunks of metal fit for a junkyard. To Bezos, they were art and history combined. "3 miles below where I'm standing right now is a wonderland that is testament to the Apollo program," he said in a video recorded on board the ship. "It looks like a magic sculpture garden, with all of these pieces from different missions that are in some cases perfectly preserved, and in other cases twisted into the beautiful shapes." Within a couple of hours, they found even more, about 330 feet away. One was buried into the seabed floor so deep they nicknamed it Lawn Dart. Over the next couple of days, they surveyed the area, taking photographs, cataloging location and conditions. Meanwhile, the weather was deteriorating, and the seas were rising. Winter storm Saturn was moving to the east, and they knew they had to move fast. "It was very rough when we got there, and it had been very rough during the transit," Concannon said. The seas laid down for the first couple of days so that we could work, but they were building, and we knew they were going to be getting worse, so we were racing the weather and racing the clock to get something on board, recover something so we could do something on the ship while we were shut down by the weather. On March 6th, the same day the storm smashed the fishing boat off the coast of Maryland a few hundred miles to the northwest, the crew of the Seabed Worker pulled up the first engine they had come across, though it wasn't clear which Apollo mission it was from. Then the storm shut them down. All they could do was wait and hope that it would soon be over. Saturn raged over them for 5 days, forcing the crew to keep the rovers out of the water. On the radar, the storm seemed to engulf all of the East Coast and much of the Atlantic, where the waves swelled and rocked the ship. The motion sickness scopolamine patches were being distributed freely, that was for sure, said Capone. They thought about trying to escape farther south to escape the storm. The problem was the storm was so big that we couldn't get away from it, Concannon explained. There was no choice, so they hung out and weathered it. For those who weren't laid up sick, there was a darts tournament, which Bezos' father won. They caught up on sleep, and they lamented violating some of Sailor's unwritten rules, especially the bananas. Mariners all over the world have a number of superstitions, Bezos said. You're not supposed to ring the ship's bell. You're not supposed to bring backpacks on board a ship, which unfortunately we did. We've got lots of bananas, and you're not supposed to bring bananas on board either. We are in the Bermuda Triangle. Somehow we now have the longest weather hold this experienced crew has ever seen. But most of all, they used the time to research the artifacts they had pulled aboard, and the ones that lay down some 3 miles below them. You don't just sit there and puke, Capone said. You work. Jeff put forth this vision, and it was our challenge to make it happen. And I can tell you, none of the crew were daunted by the storm. Yeah, it was a pain in the neck, it wasn't comfortable, and this is a large ship, almost 300-foot ship, getting battered around pretty good. But none of us was going to give up. By March 11th, the storm finally cleared, and the crew got back to work, deploying the rovers to the ocean floor. Soon they were hauling all sorts of metal aboard, working day and night. Bezos, unshaven, donned an orange jumpsuit, a hard hat, and protective goggles, and helped clear the mud from the engines. The long hours, the isolation of the sea, and the hardship from the storm stripped away status, as they adhered to a credo true in all expeditions. If you're not contributing, you're taking away. We were hosing off artifacts and cleaning mud. We were all working, Concannon said. We didn't have the CEO of Amazon. We just had Jeff, and his mom and dad, and his brother, and his brother-in-law. And everybody got their hands dirty. Everybody got little sleep. Everybody played darts when we were shut down by the weather. After several days, they had a treasure trove of engine parts, enough to declare the mission a success and head home. They had chosen to bring the engines back to Port Canaveral, returning them to the place where they had blasted off more than 4 decades before. After 3 weeks on the ocean, the seabed worker approached the coast shortly after sunrise. The crew gathered on the deck and could make out Pad 39A in the distance. They suspected that at least some of the engine parts they had recovered belonged to Apollo 11. But they didn't know for sure. The parts were brought to the Kansas Cosmosphere and Space Center, a museum that had worked for years with the Smithsonian Institution to restore and conserve aerospace artifacts. The staff there kept the parts constantly wet to prevent further corrosion, while gently rinsing the objects, blasting them with dry ice, and even removing sediment with dental picks. But they did not find any of the serial numbers that would identify what engine parts went with what mission. Based on the search area, Bezos' team was sure they had an engine from Apollo 11. They just needed to prove it. Finally, one of the conservationists had an idea. Perhaps the serial numbers they were searching for were invisible to the naked eye, but would show up under a blacklight. On his way to work one morning, he stopped to buy a blacklight and goggles. Later, as he shined it over a thrust chamber, he eventually saw 2044. He was so excited that as he ran to the phone to report his discovery, he tripped and fell, then scrambled back to his feet. Bezos announced the news to the world in another blog post on July 19th, 2013. When we stepped off the seabed worker 4 months ago in Port Canaveral, we had enough major components to fashion displays of 2 flown F1 engines. We brought back thrust chambers, gas generators, injectors, heat exchangers, turbines, fuel manifolds, and dozens of other artifacts, all simply gorgeous and a striking testament to the Apollo program. There was one secret that the ocean didn't give up easily. Mission identification. The components fiery end and heavy corrosion from 43 years underwater removed or covered up most of the original serial numbers. We left Florida knowing the conservation team had their work cut out for them, and we've kept our fingers crossed ever since. Today, I'm thrilled to share some exciting news. One of the conservators who was scanning the objects with a black light and a special lens filter had made a breakthrough discovery. 2044, stenciled in black paint on the side of one of the massive thrust chambers. 2044 is the Rocketdyne serial number that correlates to NASA number 6044, which is the series number for F1 engine number 5 from Apollo 11. The intrepid conservator kept digging for more evidence, and after removing more corrosion at the base of the same thrust chamber, he found it. Unit number 2044, stamped into the metal surface. At a depth of nearly 3 miles, some 450 miles off the Florida coast, they had found the center engine of the rocket that first took men to the moon. Since its founding in 1904, the Explorers Club had been celebrating the truly adventurous and have counted some of the world's most courageous explorers as members, from Admiral Robert Peary and Matthew Henson, the first to reach the North Pole, to Ronald Amundsen, the first to reach the South. Charles Lindbergh was a member, as was Sir Edmund Hillary, the first to summit Mount Everest with his Sherpa, Tenzing Norgay. And, of course, it also celebrated those who pioneered space, including the crew of Apollo 11, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins. Every year, the club threw a lavish black tie awards banquet at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, where the cuisine was as adventurous as the expeditions its members routinely undertook. On the menu were such delicacies as earthworm stir-fry, maggot and bug-covered strawberries, scorpions on toast, duck tongues on Belgian endives, and sweet and sour bovine penis. One year, the club's president made an entrance by riding a white horse onto the stage. The horse proceeded to poop onto the dinner plate of Edmund Hillary, who was seated on the dais. For the 2014 dinner, on March 15th, there was no horse, but there was the usual exotic fare. Skewered cockroaches, North American beaver, an ostrich egg, tarantulas, goat and goat penis, and a pair of alligators, heads still attached, that were carved up before the guests like a pig. After the feast, Buzz Aldrin came to the stage to introduce Bezos, who was accepting an award on behalf of the F1 recovery team. "Would you believe those rocket engines? Those big F1 engines that took us to fulfill the dreams of centuries and centuries," Aldrin said, apparently in awe. "The center engine of the first stage. Can you imagine? Of all these engines, Jeff happens to find that particular engine." The famous astronaut ribbed Bezos a bit about how secretive he and his space company had been. "Jeff is trying to get people up to space," Aldrin said. "But he's not telling anyone about it. He's keeping pretty quiet. But I think he's going to tell me a little bit about it." Bezos arrived on stage, beaming, and joked, "I'm still making sure there's no cockroach in my teeth." In a short speech, he said that the team had the feeling that we were recapturing history and making some history at the same time. "I can tell you for sure we had a lot of fun doing it. It wasn't quick, it was difficult to find the engines, and the hard work of finding them with the side-scan sonar had to be done very painstakingly over a very large search area. I was blown away by the professionalism and the skill of the entire team. This isn't something that can be done by a small group. You need a bunch of professionals. The group who located the engines, they were just amazing. The ROV pilots, these guys are surgeons, except they're working 3 miles down. The crane operators. Have you ever seen a crane operator work in heavy seas? The pitching deck. The whole crane starts to swing like a pendulum. These guys are such pros, and it was a joy to watch every single person on our mission. This award is definitely accepted on behalf of the entire team. He asked the crew to stand, urged the guests to applaud them, and then gushed, "These guys totally crushed it!" The F1 team wasn't the only space-related award of the evening. The president of the Explorers Club had become fascinated with Elon Musk and what he was accomplishing in space, and had decided to present him with a special President's Award. As an image of Musk in a tight-fitting t-shirt, arms crossed, biceps bulging, showed on a huge screen, Musk hopped onto the stage to accept his award. Like Bezos, Musk had come to the conclusion that the way to make spaceflight affordable was going to be recreating a reusable rocket, one that could fly as frequently as an airplane. Only then would there be the big breakthrough that would allow space to open up to the masses and allow him to get to Mars. SpaceX was getting close, and unlike Bezos, who would never have discussed Blue Origin's plans so publicly, Musk used the speech to update the guests on the company's progress. "I think what we've done thus far is evolutionary, but not revolutionary," he began. "And the thing that needs to be accomplished by SpaceX or by somebody else is a fully reusable rocket system. That's the thing that really prevents us from establishing life on Mars. The way rockets work right now is they are all expendable. So you fly them once and you throw it away. You can imagine if any mode of transport was expendable, it wouldn't be used very much. But whether it's a plane, a boat, a car, a bicycle, or a horse, they're all reusable. If a 747 costs about $250 million and you need two for a round trip, nobody is paying $500 million from London to New York and back." SpaceX had been working on developing the technology, and as Musk said, "We're starting to do the bit where we bring the booster back." The rocket to be used in the company's next launch would be outfitted for the first time with landing legs. SpaceX would try to land it on a ship at sea first, not on land, "because we're not 100% sure we can land it with pinpoint accuracy," he said. "So coming back to land would be a dodgy prospect. But it's going to try to land to a fairly precise location, deploy the gear, and then get recovered with a barge." While Musk was talking publicly about how SpaceX plans to launch, land, and reuse rockets, Bezos was quietly laying out his plans as well, in an application with the federal government that had largely escaped notice. On March 25, 2014, 10 days after Musk detailed SpaceX's plans at the Explorers Club Awards dinner, the United States Patent Office approved patent number 8678321, titled "Sea Landing of Space Launch Vehicles and Associated Systems and Methods." The 10-page patent laid out a system for recovering rockets that mimicked the approach that Musk had detailed in his speech. It laid claim to a system in which a reusable space launch vehicle is launched from a coastal launch site in a trajectory over water. After the first stage's engines cut off and it separates and begins to fall back down, the booster re-enters Earth's atmosphere in a tail-first orientation. The booster engines are then restarted, and the booster stage performs a vertical-powered landing on the deck of a seagoing platform. The technology was necessary, the patent explained, to bring down the costs of spaceflight and allow industry to push further, more efficiently. Despite the rapid advances in manned and unmanned spaceflight, delivering astronauts, satellites, and other payloads to space continues to be an expensive proposition. One reason for this is that most conventional launch vehicles are only used once, and hence are referred to as expendable launch vehicles, or ELVs. The advantages of reusable launch vehicles, RLVs, include the potential of providing low-cost access to space. The vision in the patent was expansive, detailing plans to land rockets not just in the ocean, but on other bodies of water, including, for example, a lake, a gulf, ocean, sound, or possibly even a large river. It covered the ability to launch rockets not just from land, but from sea on an ocean-going platform. And it discussed how the rockets would be serviced quickly, sometimes while on the barge being shipped back to sea, or how the booster would be transferred to smaller, faster ships in an effort to get them back to land quickly. When Musk found out about it, he was furious. After the dispute over the rights to Launchpad 39A, the patent was yet another indignity from what he felt was an inferior competitor. The idea of landing on ships at sea is something that's been discussed for like half a century, Musk recalled. The idea is not unique. It's in fictional movies. It's in multiple proposals. There's so much prior art, it's crazy. So trying to patent something that people have been discussing for half a century is obviously ridiculous. It was years later, but the dispute still stayed with Musk. Jeff one-click Bezos, he said, referring to another of Bezos's controversial patents. I mean, come on, Jeff. Leave it alone. SpaceX promptly filed suit, challenging the patent. The idea for landing rockets on ships wasn't Blue Origin's invention, Musk's lawyers argued. It had been around for years, even if Blue Origin's patent only paid lip service to the existence of prior art. If Blue's patent went unchallenged, it would hold exclusive claim over the ability to land rockets on ships, a potentially devastating blow to SpaceX. Like the Wright brothers, who had won a sweeping patent for their flying technology in 1904, Blue would be able to freeze everyone else out, or demand licensing fees for the technology. In its challenge, SpaceX demonstrated that others had conceived of the idea long before Blue Origin's patent, and had drawings to prove it. There was even a Russian sci-fi movie from 1959 that showed a rocket landing on a ship at sea. Blue Origin withdrew the majority of its claims. A win for SpaceX. The ultimate victory, though, would come when the first rockets started landing. During his speech at the Explorers Club, Musk predicted that SpaceX would be able to pull off the feat of landing on a ship at sea in one of its upcoming launches. The odds weren't going to be great for its first attempt. I think we have probably a 40% chance of making that work, he said. But the company would keep at it, like a gymnast working on his or her dismount, getting better with each attempt. We've got a bunch of launches later this year where the probability increases with each of those, he continued. But I'm starting to feel a little more confident that this could work. That, in turn, would help lower the cost of moving to Mars to under $500,000, a figure that he thought those who wanted to move to Mars could afford. At the end of the evening, the president of the Explorers Club asked all the award winners and the presenters to come to the stage and be recognized once more. They came up one by one, more than a dozen in all. Musk was at one end of the stage. Bezos was at the other. They did not speak. Chapter 12. Space is hard. The rocket detonated suddenly into a giant orange fireball, sending a mushroom cloud floating ominously in an otherwise pristine, sun-drenched Texas sky. Bits of debris scattered, trailing smoke and fire on the way down like fireworks in a display as beautiful as it was violent. As it climbed a few hundred feet over the company's McGregor test site, the rocket had suddenly spun out of control and started falling back down. Before it could get too far off course, its flight termination system kicked in, blowing the rocket up a few hundred feet above the prairie. No one was injured, and it was only a test, one that SpaceX stressed was particularly complex, pushing the limits of the vehicle further than any previous test. Elon Musk even had coined an acronym for such spectacular failures, RUD, or Rapid Unscheduled Disassembly. But it was also a reminder that for all the advancements in rocket science, launches were really just controlled explosions of a combustible mix of propellants. As Musk knew as well as anyone, one small error, even something as small as a corroded nut, could send the whole thing up in flames. Still so damn intense, Musk had tweeted after a recent launch. Looking forward to it feeling normal one day. After the rocket test explosion, he tweeted, "Rockets are tricky." Still, SpaceX had rattled off an improbable string of successful launches of the Falcon 9 without a single failure. It was an amazing streak stretching over 4 years that was beginning to make the exercise feel routine. But Musk still sweated every one, shooting an email to the entire company, urging employees to step forward if anyone had